Well, again, it's good to be here with you this morning. And as we've been looking at the family, we, a couple weeks ago, began to look at the home as it is now, as after the fall, and the rules and the guidelines and the structure that God set into place. We were looking at the role of husbands in the family, and the way God has laid out their task. Now, what we start off looking at is the important element that if we're going to have Christian families that are built and founded as Christian homes, number one, fathers have to build and continue to work on their spiritual journey with Christ. I think in order to have good, strong Christian fathers, you need to be a strong Christian, or at least someone, maybe we're not strong now, but it's something that's important to us and that we're continually working on. We all know and understand that all of us struggle. But I think the struggle is important. I think it's interesting when you look at the people of God in the Old Testament. Who are they?
David.
Who? Well, what was the name of their family?
The Israelites.
The Israelites. Now, why did God change Jacob's name to Israel? Do you know why? He what?
Jacob met supplanter, right? And sorry.
Yeah. Why did he get the name Israel? So God changed his name to Israel because he wrestled with God. You remember the time when he wrestled with the angel, and the angel touched the hip of his socket and put it out of joint, but he wouldn't let go. And so God eventually changed his name to Israel. Well, then the name Israel means what? To wrestle with God. This idea that that we are constantly struggling with what Paul would say in Romans 7 is the spiritual person and the fleshly person. And there's that constant battle. And you see it through the history of the nation of Israel, where they constantly fought with God. They also fought with themselves constantly over time. Well, the same is true with us. We are all in the midst of that battle of fighting almost, in reality, against ourselves. Our spiritual side is warring with our fleshly side because they want two different things. Well, that doesn't stop at the door. At the door of our homes, right? When we come into our homes with our families, as you're trying to be a husband or a wife or a child in that home, you're fighting that battle. And what does that create in a family sometimes?
Division,
friction. Conflict. We're going to talk about conflict this morning in our sermon. But conflict. And so when we delve more into sin, what is that innately going to do with the rest of our relationships in the family? Conflict breeds conflict. And if we're not at peace with God, how are we going to be at peace with our family? And so our as husbands, and the same will be true when we talk about wives, is that the husband needs to have that strong relationship with Christ. And maybe we're not there. Maybe we're not there, but that ought to be a goal in our life. One of the things I think is a big killer of churches all around the world, and especially locally, let's just think in our own country, is apathy. Spiritual apathy is a cancer in the church. And it eats congregations up when we become apathetic, when we just don't care anymore. Well, in a marriage relationship, if you have a husband, a father, or a wife who is apathetic, what's that going to do to the relationship? What's that going to do to the family? Well, it starts by becoming spiritually aware and awakened and driving toward that. And so I want to go to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, and we're going to spend some time here in discussing the family. Paul so eloquently here uses the home, the family, the husband and wife relationship. He uses that as an illustration to describe the church. And so he's going to make some parallel arguments between the church ought to be this way because look at how it is in the family. And so what I want to do, let's just turn there and I want to read this text and then we're going to break it down. So somebody, if you don't mind, let's read 22. Well, let's start just for this discussion. Let's start in verse 25. Let's start at verse 25 and read through 33. Ephesians 5, 25 through 33. Somebody read that.
Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought to also love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is also to love his own wife, even as himself. And the wife must see to it that she respects her husband.
Okay, so he in verse 25 and in verse 33, how does Paul bookend his discussion? He puts a bookend on one end and on the other end, and it's parallels. What is it?
Christ, it's got to be a part of the husband and the wife.
Okay. Husbands need to love their wives.
Husbands need to love their wives. Now, everybody in here would be like, of course. Who would say differently? Husband, hate your wife, right? But is that... what's he exploring here that maybe is something that the world doesn't think about in regard to love?
Love's an action word.
It's an action, right? We talked about that last week. I won't go back into the whole discussion. We talked about the word here is agape, right? That's where we get our English word agape, right? That we are to love the sacrificial kind of love. Yes, ma'am. Great point. You know, you think about the concept of love here is not a one-time act. It's not one time going out and getting flowers or chocolates or doing something kind for somebody one time. But this is a ongoing relationship characteristic, right? That your relationship with your wife should be characterized how? By love. In John chapter 13, Jesus says, the world will know we are his disciples by what? I think it's verse 35. By what? By our love for one another, right? That's how the world identifies us as Christ followers, as Christians, by the love we have for one another. The same concept here, isn't it? It isn't this one-time action, but it is an ongoing thing. And the thing he premises this by, and the same thing in John 13, is that, I think it's in verse 34 of John 13, he says, I give you a new commandment. You're to love your neighbor as yourself. Well, any Old Testament reader will know right away, well, that's what's new about that? I mean, God's been saying that since Moses, right? But then he goes on to say, the new part is, as I have loved you. Right? He takes what this concept that the Hebrews had about love, and he gives them a higher bar. Right? It's more than just as you love yourself. It's more than just as you love somebody who loves you. It's as I, Christ, have loved you. And so when you come to the husband and wife relationship, he explores this several times here, where it's not just enough to love by the standard that the world says to love. Right? Husbands, that's not your standard. Do not look out the window to your neighbor who's not a Christian and say, well, you know, that's I'll look at John across the street and if, you know, I'll judge my love by him. You don't do that. Don't even come into the services and look across the auditorium and say, I'm going to judge, you know, like he loves his wife. That's not it. Paul says what you should do is open your Bible up, turn to Matthew 26 and following, or any of the Gospels, and look at how Jesus loved the church. Examine that. That's the basis. That's the standard of your love. Now, what husband in here would raise your hand if I asked you, who lives up to that? None of us do, right? None of us do. But are we striving for that? That's the goal. That's the goal. And so as we move through this, I think that's the theme here that keeps coming back up. So the husband, verse 28. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. What do you think Paul is saying? He who loves his wife loves himself.
She's an extension of him. They've become one.
Okay, great point. What did Adam say after Eve and he were there placed in the garden? Even after the sin situation. Into chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. What did Adam say about Eve?
Well,
he said, now this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. What is he saying there? It's an extension of himself. But even more than that, I think there's more of an integration that goes on there. Later in Matthew chapter, I always get the chapters confused, but I think it's, let me look it up. I don't want to misquote myself or misquote the Bible. Yeah, that's right. Matthew 19, Jesus, in a discussion about divorce, brings up this topic of the joining of a husband and wife. And what does he say? So they're trying to get him into some kind of, they brought in their lawyers and the Pharisees are trying to trick Jesus into committing some kind of error biblically. Never separate, because why?
They're one flesh.
They're one flesh. But what's the big underlining thing there? They're never to separate. Let not man separate what?
What God
has joined together. So Jesus says there's something more than just some kind of agreement between two people to live together. There's something deeper here. There's something on a spiritual level. Paul says in the Corinthian letter that those who are joined together are one spirit. That's why he goes on in that book to talk about, that's why you don't go to prostitutes. Because you don't join someone in that way. That there's something deeper to that. When we, in Romans chapter 1, Paul talking about the depravity of homosexuality, says that it's so evil because why? It's not just a
sin against flesh.
It's not like other sin, what?
It's a sin against the flesh and God.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a deeper thing going on there. And so when a husband and wife have been joined by God, there's a deeper meaning to that. And so Paul in Ephesians 5:28 says, when we love our wives as Christ loved the church, we are loving ourselves. We need to see, husbands, your wife as more than just another person in your home who happens to sleep in your bed beside of you. They are really a part of you. There's a union going on there. And so that's why he'll say, you know, you don't mistreat your body. I hope not. If you do, we know what. There's something going on. We need treatment for that. Because that's not right, right? We try to take care of our bodies. That's why we go to doctors. That's why we seek treatments. That's why we hopefully, not always, but try to eat right. Or at least think about eating right. That'd be a really good idea if I stopped eating all those sweets and candies, right? And that's hard to do. But we have a concern. That's why we have all the mirrors we do in our homes. We have a concern about that. Well, Paul says, you need to see your wife as a part of you, right? And how you treat her really does have a deeper spiritual meaning to it. He says, verse 29, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it. And then he gives us another comparison here. So another standard to live up to. What does he say at the end of verse 29?
Even as the Lord loves the church. Even as the Lord loves the church.
Now, for a minute, husbands, let's think about what if Jesus treated us, the church, like we treated our wives sometimes? Would you be a little bit embarrassed about your behavior if you were the standard of how he treated the church? We might be, right? Well, he says we need to have the same kind of care and attention to our spouse as we do Christ and the church. And so you see how what he's doing is he's saying, I'm not giving you a worldly standard to live up to. I'm not trying to give you some inspirational speaker, some motivational speaker's version of how a husband and wife ought to interact. I'm telling you, when you want to know, am I treating my spouse, my wife, like I should? Well, look at how Jesus treats the church and ask yourself, would you want Jesus to treat you the way you're acting? And so I think that's a very kind of penetrating thing, isn't it? Sorry, I don't know, my voice is a little squeaky today. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. Well, before we go there, let's see. Kind of talked about that. I told you wrong earlier. I told you Genesis chapter 3 is that statement about bone of bone, flesh of flesh. But that was chapter 2. I'm sorry. Genesis chapter 2 is where Adam says, now this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. And then I want to go back to Genesis chapter 2. I don't have it up here on the board, but let's go back there just real quickly. after God has formed Adam from dust of the ground, took the rib and formed Eve, and he sets him in the garden, what is the statement there made about Adam and Eve? You notice verse 23, then the man said, this at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Now notice verse 24. Therefore a man shall, what? Leave father and mother, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Now, some translations will have there in verse 24, he shall hold fast to his wife. Some translations will have the term there, cleave to his wife. What's that term cleave mean in your mind?
Hold too tightly.
Hold too tightly. I think about a young child around a parent's leg. You ever have your children grab you around the leg and hold on? Either because they're afraid or you're somewhere new, right? Why are they doing that?
They trust you.
They trust you. What? They're afraid to be separated.
That's where their comfort is.
It's a big, scary world out there, isn't it? Your children ever try to go out and explore and then run back to you? If you watch them as they grow up and get bigger, they start to go out further, don't they? But where do they always come back to? Wherever that place of safety is. All right? But you think about that idea of them cleaving to one another. Right, I'm going to hold on so tightly that I'm not going to let go. Right? I'm holding on, and so he says here that husband and wife are to cleave together. And then he began by saying what that you should do what? You should leave your father and mother. This is something I talk about anytime I do marriage counseling with young people. This is an important thing to talk about. Do we ever struggle to leave mom and dad when we're younger? Because again, that's our place of safety, our refuge, right? For some of us, I know it's not always the case, but for many people, or it can be hard to leave home, right? To kind of sever that tie. But there's an important thing going on here, isn't there? This idea of leaving father, mother. Well, what do you think he's meaning by that? Of course you're going to move into your own house, right?
Priority.
What?
You're shifting your priority.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what does that mean?
It means you don't need them. Also, a lot of the problem, you don't need them once you get married or whatever. You don't need mom and dad on either side telling you what to do anymore. That only causes trouble. That's where the husband and the wife come in as one, together. She don't need it, and I don't need it. So.
Absolutely. Also, when there's trouble, there will be trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Right? How long were y'all, those who are married, how long were you married before you had trouble? All right? Trouble comes, everybody. But what's an instinct sometimes is to want to run back to mommy and daddy. I don't know how many people sit down and talk with and they want to run back to, there's a problem and one of them's wanting to run back to mommy and daddy because I feel safer there. All right? But he says, no, you can't do that. You have to cleave to one another. And so, like was mentioned, that devotion has to shift. I'm no longer devoted to mom and dad. I'm devoted to my spouse. Did you have something, Michelle?
Well, I was going to say, on a side note, parents need to allow that to happen also.
Good point.
I've seen parents in relationships where they don't allow the children to have that relationship on their own. It's being too nosy.
That's the world
or
today.
Or controlling.
Yeah, the world today is different than what me and Connie had been married 3 months when I was told I had 2 years to live. If I'd been her, I would have cut and run. And that was many, many years ago. So.
But it seems like there's two instincts, right, parents? There's the parent who's ready to go, whoop.
Yep.
You know, you're old enough, go. And then there's the parent who wants to tether a string to their child, right? You go out of there. I don't want you getting too far away. It's like you go to the amusement parks, and I always thought this was silly, but after you have kids, you kind of understand it. But you remember when they tie their kids up like little puppy dogs. I never understood that. But as you get older and your kids start wandering off, okay, maybe I get that a little bit more than I used to. But, right? But sometimes it's one thing to do that with your child who you're protecting, who's little, and this is a dark, scary world. It's another thing to do that when they're 18, 19, 20, 25, 30 years old, and you've still got a string tethered to them. Pull them back, right? He says you need to leave, father, mother, and father, mother need to let you leave. And to move on and to cling to your spouse. I want to go to Proverbs chapter 5. We'll come, I don't have it up there either. Proverbs chapter 5. I want to read a text here and talk about something. Proverbs chapter 5, and somebody read 18 through 20, please. Proverbs 5, 18 through 20.
Let thy fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving kind and pleasant robe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman, and embrace the bosom of a stranger?
All right, so that word ravished there in the King James is translated in some other versions as intoxicated or intoxication. You meant the word intoxicated. We're usually talking about alcohol or drugs, right? What does it mean to be intoxicated?
Consumed.
Doesn't mean something else is controlling you.
Controlling.
Something else is controlling you.
Okay. Okay. Something's controlling you. Because, yeah, yeah. Any other thoughts on intoxication?
Well, usually they're trying to run away from something.
Oh, well, yeah, if you're talking about drugs or alcohol, you can run away, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's this idea of being drawn into something, right? Something that takes your focus and attention. We're talking about drugs and alcohol. When we think about intoxication, we think the drugs are controlling your thinking. They make you less reasonable, maybe, or less able to reason. They blur your thinking. All right. Of course, that's not what we're talking about here exactly, but it's this idea of being enthralled by. Now, he's talking to, this is advice from a mother to her son, who's now getting out into the world and experiencing the world. And he says that his wife should what? Or he should, how should, I'm sorry, maybe the way I'm thinking about this is, what should his response be toward his wife?
He should be completely addicted to her.
He should be addicted to her. All of his focus and attention. What gets more men into trouble than anything else?
Women.
What?
Women.
Well.
Same thing for women, men.
Well, but I'm worried that by saying that, what are we saying? We're putting it off on somebody else. It's their fault.
Well,
their own
loss. It's us, though, isn't it? It's us. It's the wandering eye. It's the fixation on fleshly things. How many men have gotten in trouble because their eyes begin to wander? And they're looking at things and in places they shouldn't. And so he says, don't be intoxicated with what? With a prostitute. But be infatuated, intoxicated by your wife. Uh, I wonder if we, if that old saying, idle hands are the devil's playground, isn't really true. What is that? What does that old saying mean? Idle hands are the devil's playground.
Got too much time on your hands. Got
too much time.
You get into trouble, but you're not actively pursuing something.
Okay.
If you're not looking for something, something's looking for you.
Okay.
I got to take up for the woman too. A wife that's got kids and got a house, everything. Sometimes they don't want to play.
Yeah, and so that's why I think she's focusing solely on him, right? This is what your response should be. You should be intoxicated with your wife. You should be focused and attentive to her. Idle hands is the devil's playground. When we begin to, we're made to work. Do you know that? We're made to work. God placed Adam and Eve in the garden, and what did he tell them?
That's not what the government wants.
But the reality is, when God put Adam and Eve in the garden, he said, I want you to care for it. God knows something about us. We need a focus and attention in our life. Some kind of work to focus on. How many of us find ourselves getting into trouble most often during idleness when we don't have other things to occupy our mind? How many of us find it difficult to get into trouble when we have a job to do and we're focused on it and that's what we're doing, and then all these other things, I can't focus on that, I can't, I've got to focus here. Well, the same is true in a marriage, isn't it? If I am focused on my family, on my spouse, and that's where my attention is, I don't have room for all this other stuff. I begin to wonder and look around when I say, well, you know, I just don't want to do anything. Right? And we lose focus. It says, let your wife be intoxicating to you, if I paraphrase that. Let her intoxicate your attention. Give her your focus and attention, not other women.
This past week, I had a very deep conversation with one of my good friends that has been married about a year. And it was a hard conversation, but you know, just like throughout it, like the undertone of what he was saying, you know, he was struggling. And, you know, the undertone of what I could understand from what his wife was saying, you know, it sounded like she wasn't getting the emotional things that she needed. And, you know, in return, she wasn't having the physical stuff with him, right? And I think, you know, kind of what, something that another one of my friends says, you know, like usually when there's physical problems, it's the result of a closeness problem. Mm-hmm. And if you're not giving your wife the emotional support that she needs, a lot of the solution is building a better relationship, and then that can help with a lot of these other problems.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think why is there a closeness problem? Well, it's because one or both of you are not focused where you should be. Your attention is somewhere else. You're focused on something or someone else. Can't do that. You can't have split loyalties. It works the same way with God, right? Can we be focused on God and everything else?
No.
In our worldly relationships, who's the most important person to us? It ought to be your spouse. There ought not be anybody more important to you than your spouse, and I'm including your children. Love our children. Love them dearly. Can't be more important than your spouse. That idea of being wrapped up in one another, and that you're both on a journey together. And And so we think practically, you're, most of us don't work with our spouse, right? That's very rare. Most of us work somewhere else. One of the things I think that where this really becomes dangerous is, I don't know if we realize this or not, but there are a lot of us who spend more time at work just because of the nature of the beast. We spend more time at work than we do with our families. You think about that. It kind of makes sense how Satan can get in there and begin to drive at our focus. And that's why when we work too much and we become too focused on work, it can really be a drag on our relationships. But it's also at work. I should have looked this up. It's in our work relationships where most often the affairs occur, where people step out of their relationship and get involved with someone they shouldn't, is most often at work. Because we're away from our spouse. When we're not together, it's easy to lose focus on them. Well, I'm not saying we all quit our jobs and move into a commune and all work and live together and build one of those societies. But it does mean that we need to be aware of the dangers of losing focus on what's truly important. At the end of the day, are you going to stick with your job or your family?
It's where your values are at, it's what you'll choose.
What?
It's where your values are, it's what you'll choose. Which one of those you'll choose? Will you worship the dollar more or the family? Yeah. There's a pecking order. God comes first and then family. And the family is wife, children, so on down the line. So.
Lord willing, we're all going to retire one day, aren't we? And we're going to do something else. Either we're going to move into retirement, we're going to spend our last years, you know, doing things with our family, around our home, or we're going to retire and move on to another job. We're going to do something else.
Or you're going to retire and be broke.
Who's going to be there, though?
You're expelled.
That person who's been sleeping in the bed beside you, I hope you're still sleeping in the same bed together. Should be. That person laying across from you, they're going to be there. Why do people have problems at retirement?
They don't know how to live together.
They've been apart
never
so
spent
long.
Time together.
I've seen that happen.
It's a sad thing, but I don't know. I don't know the numbers, and so I won't make any kind of judgment whether it's worse today than it used to be. But it is so sad to me to see couples who've been married 20, 30, 40 years get divorced. And I scratch my head, but at why? Why does that happen? And I don't know if it's exactly true. I would surmise that maybe some of it has to do with this. They spent their whole life focused on something else. And so that's drawn all their attention. And so they've ignored all the family issues, all the relationship issues. But then when they retire, what do they come face to face with?
You go off and you go to work for 8 to 10 hours a day, whatever it is, and you don't see each other. Then when you retire, you're together. I mean, that's what me and Connie dealt with. We had to learn to live 24 hours a day together. Because me and Connie's one of the few people I know, if I go to the doctor, she goes with me. She goes, I go with her. We've just always done that. We're together, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
So this idea of being intoxicated with each other is so important. You think about, I know I got to end right here, but Dwayne's shaking his head. He's like, it's time to be done. I'm just kidding. But in our lives, we go through separations, right? We separate from jobs. Now, it seems like in our economy, that's becoming even more of a thing where people, it's rare for someone to stay in a job for 30 years. But what's sad is at the same time, marriages seem to be doing the same thing. There almost seems to be a parallel between those two. We're separating. Which of those two is the greater divorce?
Marriage.
Marriages, isn't it?
Yes.
But which one do we have the most heartache about sometimes?
Jobs, money.
our attention, our focus as husbands needs to be on our families, on our wives. That'll help us overcome so much. We'll continue this next week. We'll get into talking about the role of a wife in the home. Then please pick up the family devotionals are out there on the table. Pick that up. Please spend some time with that with your family this week. Thank you so much.